you be seated.
The court is ready to hear from petitioners in Baker Hughes versus Kepler.
May it please the court. Ms. Claudia Frost will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner Kepler, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. Baker Hughes is before the court today requesting the court to render the judgment that the trial court and the Court of Appeals should have rendered. Specifically, Baker Hughes is here asking the court to affirm the trial court's summary judgment on limitations, which the Court of Appeals erroneously reversed by unconstitutionally applying Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code Section 16010 to that claim. Baker Hughes also asked the court to render the judgment the trial court should have rendered with respect to its motion for summary judgment for breach of contract. The Court of Appeals erroneously dodged that issue in its incorrect interpretation of Cincinnati Life versus Tate. Baker Hughes submits that if this court takes these actions as requested, that the other issues in this appeal will be moot. Before I discuss the constitutional issue or the breach of contract summary judgment issue, I thought it might be useful to give the court a little bit of brief background, and if I may, I will. The plaintiff's petition, which was filed in October of 1993, alleged a breach of a confidential disclosure agreement by Baker Hughes' predecessor. Just for ease of reference during this argument, I'm going to refer to the entities I represent as Baker Hughes. Baker Hughes acquired Trecor Atlas, which was the party to the confidential disclosure agreement, changed its name to Houston Atlas at some point, and again to EnviroTech Controls. So Baker Hughes represents those parties for this purpose. The petition the plaintiff filed alleged, and the court has looked at it, it's a very short and very unusual pleading. It claims that Baker Hughes manufactured products or components of original Kiko design in competition with Kiko that violated the confidential disclosure agreement. Kiko sought actual damages for that violation. They also claimed that Baker Hughes conspired to breach the contract with EnviroTech, its own division. And then they also claimed that punitive damages were appropriately awardable for the defendant's undefined outrageous conduct. After some discovery, and the case was pending for a while, in May of 1994, Baker Hughes moved for summary judgment. It appeared that the gravamen of the plaintiff's complaint was that Baker Hughes had purchased conditioning units from someone other than Kiko. Specifically, Baker Hughes, after relations with Kiko soured and fell apart, Baker Hughes began buying conditioning units from a company called Kintech. It was Kiko's complaint, really, that we were no longer buying conditioning units from them, but instead were buying them from Kintech. Because Baker Hughes did not manufacture any conditioning units at all, and the claim in the case was that we had breached the agreement by manufacturing these conditioning units of original Kiko design in competition, the only way that could have occurred is through our purchase of conditioning units from Kintech.
Now, is this undisputed in the record, or is it disputed in the record about whether Baker Hughes manufactures these conditioning?
It's undisputed that Baker Hughes does not manufacture. The dispute centers on whether Kintech's manufacturer violates this agreement. It's really the nut of it. The only way Kintech could have allegedly manufactured these devices in competition and of original Keiko design was by Baker Hughes providing them with some sort of trade secret or confidential information. To the extent, because punitive damages were sought, outrageous conduct was alleged, to the extent that there was a possible allegation of a misappropriation of trade secret as the tortious conduct underlying these pleadings, Baker Hughes moved for summary judgment on the basis that any misappropriation of trade secret or confidential information was barred by the two-year statute of limitations. That, and the court granted that motion, and correctly. The record is clear that in April of 1991, KECO's president wrote to Baker Hughes telling Baker Hughes that they had violated the agreement by publishing a paper or delivering a paper at a trade conference, and that paper, they later testified, contained trade secrets. So in April 1991, they alleged a breach of the agreement and a misappropriation or disclosure of a trade secret. Under this court's later decision in Altai, the cause of action for misappropriation of trade secrets accrues when the misappropriation occurs. If the misappropriation is, as they alleged, our giving confidential information or trade secrets to Kintec to make a competing device, that also occurred in the April-May 1991 timeframe.
Does it matter? I mean, the later date of them providing the piece of equipment, if limitations ran from there, it would still be barred.
Correct. So yes, it doesn't matter, Your Honor, whether you're looking at April or May. They didn't file their suit until October of 1993, well outside the two-year statute of limitations.
Ms. Cross, was what you're just talking about, limitations, the only ground in the May 94 motion for summary,
yes,
the contract manufacturer business was not part of that.
Correct.
Right?
That was a subsequent motion. I'm turning to that right now. Baker Hughes then, after the tort claims were disposed of, or any implicit tort claims in the pleading were disposed of by the court's motion, Baker Hughes filed a contract motion for summary judgment on June 22nd of 1994.
Now, there was a reference to by KECO that part of his suit on the breach of contract was the contract was a requirements contract. But you haven't referenced that as part of the pleadings are on file when this summary judgment comes.
No, Your Honor, it never becomes part of the pleadings in this case. The pleading that I referred to, the very terse page and a half pleading, is all that this case was ever based on. The requirements contract is something that they came up with in one of their responses to our summary judgment motion. There is nothing in the contract, if the court would look at it, to say there's a requirements contract. Really, where they try to go with that requirements contract notion is based on some alleged oral understandings they claim occurred between the parties. There's no pleading to support a breach of an oral contract, and there's no evidence that there was such a contract or that a requirements contract is involved. Moreover, when that was discussed,
so in your view, that's not an issue in this case.
It should not be. No, it's certainly not an issue that we ever thought was appropriately raised by the pleading, and it was discussed in the summary judgment motion. And Baker Hughes did file a response to their claim of a requirements contract by saying, first of all, it's not a requirements contract. Look at the contract. It isn't. Second, to the extent you're claiming some sort of oral agreement, there's no evidence of any oral agreement here. Plus, there's no pleading to support a breach of an oral agreement. And third, any kind of requirements contract would probably, of the type they were suggesting existed here, would violate the anti-competitive laws in any event.
But you don't. If it's a part of the summary judgment motion, and it's a part of the response to the summary judgment motion, and you're arguing that the summary judgment should have been granted based on Baker Hughes' materials,
right,
whether or not it's a requirements contract is an issue that we have to reach.
I think it's only an issue, Your Honor, yes, you certainly can look at it. I do not believe it's supported by any pleading, though, and that should not have prevented the court from granting a summary judgment motion to us on the basis of breach of contract, because it's totally unsupported.
Now I think I understand.
Okay. Baker Hughes did move for summary judgment on the ground that it didn't breach the confidential disclosure agreement with KIKO, basically on setting forth evidence to refute at least one, and I think three, of the essential elements of KIKO's claim. First, we submitted the affidavit of the knowledgeable Baker Hughes employee who dealt with Kintec, and the request for providing us a substitute conditioning unit because of our problems with KIKO. Mr. Heyman dealt with Kintec, and he submitted an affidavit, which supports our summary judgment, that the only information that he gave to Kintec when he called them and asked them would they please design a conditioner, build a conditioning unit for us, was Baker Hughes' test data and Baker Hughes' performance requirements. Under the confidential disclosure agreement, absolutely, unequivocally, and clearly, Baker Hughes' test data belongs to Baker Hughes. It's the last page of the agreement, last paragraph. It says that. Secondly, performance requirements are the requirements that Baker Hughes had for the performance of the unit that it imposed on any manufacturer. Neither one of those pieces of information or types of information were confidential or trade secret. In their response to our motion for summary judgment, they did not take issue with this. In fact, they didn't really even address it other than to kind of flip it off as being sort of immaterial, because what they focused on was what they said was the ultimate issue in the case, and that is, did the Texas Ranger, their product, which we gave to Kintec, did it contain trade secrets? That was how they defended, principally defended the summary judgment based on that. The trial court denied our breach of contract motion for summary judgment. And we believe that was erroneous, and we request this court to review that issue and render the judgment that the trial court should have rendered, because what is unequivocal and uncontroverted is that Kintec never used the Ranger. Never. There is no evidence controverting the fact that Kintec never used it. In fact, the person, Mr. McKinley, who was in charge of building the unit at Kintec could not even really remember ever having had it, and surmised only that if he had it, the only thing he would have used it for was to measure the opening to see where the conditioning unit connected to Baker Hughes's bigger product so that he could make sure the diameter was appropriate. But he wasn't even sure he did that.
Well, this wasn't a no evidence.
No,
it
was not.
Their burden to come forward with that type of evidence.
No, it wasn't, but we came forward with the evidence that they didn't use.
But wasn't there testimony that a disassembled Ranger was provided?
Yes, and we came forward with evidence that although it was provided, Kintec never used it. Therefore, there could be no causation or no damages.
But that's not readily controvertible, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it is readily controvertible from Mr. Kimball. Mr. Kimball, the president of KIKO, could very easily, I think, have come in by affidavit and said what needed to, that it was, in order for them to have designed that product, they would have had to have had the disassembled unit. Here is the Kintec product, which they could have acquired. Here's the Kintec product. It is the same as my product. Here is how they could not have built it without copying my product. Here is how it did copy my product. There's no affidavit evidence of any kind like that. The only affidavit evidence comes much, much later after the summary judgment's denied. There's one piece of evidence that comes in a year later where he says that KIKO's president says that in his opinion that they couldn't have designed it that quickly had they not had more information than just the Ranger, and had they had the Ranger and used it. But that was much longer after the summary judgment was denied, wasn't before the court then, and it's a conclusion that we think cannot create a fact issue.
Let me ask you quickly about statute of limitations.
Certainly.
I'm not sure I understood your argument. Do you concede, essentially, that the statute on its face does apply to the claims here?
No. No. We do not. The 16010 statute, the Civil Practice and Remedies Act statute, no. It does not. We do not believe that the court can, well, if the question is the Court of Appeals supposed to apply the law in effect at the time of its decision and it was okay for it to look at 16010? Sure.
No, the question is, on its face, did the legislature intend for that statute to apply?
To apply to this case? Yes, this statute would apply to this type of case, but it would be unconstitutional to apply it to this case on these facts.
So you're not trying to mount an argument that the wording itself would not allow you to apply the statute to this case since judgment had been entered before?
We think that the second enabling or effective date provision of the statute is probably unconstitutional, period. Because I can't fathom a case where it could be applied constitutionally when it would be relevant, when the statute had, for example, already run when the case was filed. I hope that's responsive.
As far as the constitutional question goes, do you want us to find an error in the Court of Appeals for not addressing that point and remand it to the Court of Appeals to address the constitutional issue?
Your Honor, certainly that is an alternative prayer that we have.
Which would be the appropriate?
The appropriate thing, we believe, would be under either the Lujan case or former Rule 180 for this court to render the judgment that the court, lower court, should have rendered. See my time
questions?
Is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready for your argument from the respondent.
David Bryant will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is David Bryant. I'm here on behalf of Kiko R&B. I'm not really sure where to start. I think the court has had an opportunity to review some of the record, and I think the statements by counsel for petitioner were not entirely correct. The issue of whether or not there was a requirements contract was raised by petitioners in their counterclaim. We responded in a motion for summary to a motion for summary judgment and alleged that it was indeed a requirements contract, just as petitioners had alleged in their counterclaim. If you look at the contract itself, it does provide for the requirements arrangement, where KECO would be providing all of Baker Hughes' requirements for this particular device. Now, with respect to the provision of the Texas Ranger to Kentech, we do contest whether or not this constitutes a breach of contract in and of itself. It's at least evidence of an intent to participate in the manufacture of a competing product.
How could that be when Mr. Kimbrell testified in his affidavit that you couldn't reverse engineer?
Well, the other part to that, Your Honor, is that in order for them to have participated in the manufacture of that product, they would have also had to have provided confidential information, trade secret information, to Kentech. And that's
what did they have other than their test results that they were entitled to?
Well, if you look at the affidavit of Charlie Kimball, I think in the summary judgment responses, this was a relationship that was developed over time. The confidential disclosure agreement was signed, I think, in December of 1989.
Well, my question is, what did they have besides test data that they were entitled to and a product that you couldn't tell anything about?
I believe the record discloses that Mr. Kimball, in response to questions from Baker Hughes, provided additional information about how the product is actually manufactured. And that gave rise to the request for the disclosure agreement, for the confidential disclosure agreement.
So, but you concede, as Mr. Kimball appears to say, that the article does not inform one how to build a Texas Ranger. It's been manufactured in such a way that an unauthorized opening will result in the destruction of critical portions of the device, and even if it didn't, all you could know were some things, but not everything, not enough.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
So that turns on whether the breach of contract issue then turns on whether KECO gave Baker Hughes some other confidential information besides test results and the product itself.
Well, I believe that's only part of it.
Okay.
I think our argument is twofold. The first part is what you just said, that the provision of trade secrets in order to manufacture this product was a breach of the contract. But if you look at the terms of the agreement, it says that Traco Atlas will not manufacture, in competition with Kiko, a component of original Kiko design. All right. If the UCC applies to this contract, which petitioners admit that it does, in fact, they claim they had a right to cover under UCC 2715, if that's true, then there is an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. The case law that interprets that in the restatement section, restatement of contracts, specifically states that you cannot engage in this kind of subterfuge, basically hiring someone else to do your dirty work, the things that you can't do by virtue of your contract. Now,
well, did they, is there any evidence or charge that Chemtech and Baker Hughes shared in the profits of this, or that this was a joint enterprise?
Well, I think they necessarily did, John. I'm not sure if that was specifically addressed in that manner, but necessarily Chemtech's going to profit from it, and so is Baker Hughes, by virtue of the fact that Baker Hughes is going to have a replacement product, and Chemtech is going to have a new customer. So I think they both did profit. I'm not sure if it was a joint enterprise or something like that. But nevertheless, I think petitioners are implying that we are raising for the first time on appeal the issue of this subterfuge. I think if you look at the responses to the motions for summary judgment, we've always said that the actions of Baker Hughes in cooperating with Chemtech to come up with this substitute product constitutes a breach of contract, however you look at it. I just merely, in my brief, I just cited the law that supports that conclusion, that is indeed a breach of contract. So I don't believe that's something that's been raised for the first time in this court.
Let me ask you, your argument that
why would the issue of whether or not the limitations period vested? Well, there's a couple of reasons for that, Your Honor. First of all, you've got the fact that the limitations period, Civil Practice and Remedies Code Section 16.003, is an accrual statute. And at the point in time this lawsuit was filed, that's when you determine what the law is applicable to the case in terms of whether limitations apply. Right? If the case law had not determined whether or not the discovery rule was applicable to the trade secrets claim, I don't see how the right to rely upon limitations could have vested at that time. If you look
But wasn't that issue finalized in Alcott?
Well, Your Honor, this court did rule that the discovery rule does not apply in 1996. Since that time, the legislature has come back in and said the discovery rule does apply. Now, that's a question in this case. I've got the opinion of the Court of Appeals.
But I understand you say that whether the discovery rule applied or not, while the case was in trial court, was uncertain, and therefore there was no vested right in that constitutional argument, their limitations defense. I'm having a hard time understanding why it was unsettled while the case was in trial court.
Because of the status of the law, Your Honor. If you look at the...
But Alheim decided that.
In 1996, that's right.
And wasn't the case still pending in the trial court?
No, Your Honor. I believe the decision came out during the same month that the court in this case entered for a final judgment. I don't believe, I think March 1st was the date that the...
Well, Alta came out in March of 96.
Yes, yes, sir.
And the trade secret motion was granted in June of 96.
That's when, I believe that's when the final judgment...
Well, final judgment, but in any event, it was still pending in trial court when this issue was settled. So, I'm having a hard time understanding the vested right argument or the statement that the law was uncertain. It was certainly determined at a point in time in the trial court when it could have affected the entry of final judgment.
That's correct. My point was that at the time suit was filed, when you looked to determine whether limitations had run, the law was unsettled. Now, I take the position that this is not even an issue in this case by virtue of the fact that the Court of Appeals opinion does not work the way the petitioners claim it works. I admit it could have been more articulate with respect to whether or not the 3-year period of limitations applies to this case. But if you look at the language of the opinion, that's not what the court did. What the court did was apply the discovery rule. Plain and simple. If just consider this, Your Honors, if the court had in fact applied the 3-year limitations period, it would have been wholly unnecessary for the court to consider when Kiko knew or should have known of its claims, of its injuries. In terms of the opinion, I'd just like to point it out for the court if I could, because I think it's important. Page 9 of the original slip opinion. It cites the new statute. It goes on, it says, Kiko's suit was pending on May 1st, 1997. Accordingly, the three-year statute of limitations applies. Very next sentence. The evidence raises a fact issue about when the misappropriation was or should have been discovered and whether the suit was timely filed. Therefore, summary judgment was inappropriate. If the court had actually applied the three-year limitations period, Your Honor, it wouldn't have been necessary to discuss the discovery rule. Under the three-year limitations period, the suit would have been timely filed without consideration.
But the new statute is where the discovery rule kicks in. So the discussion of the discovery rule also comes from the statute.
That's true.
So
that's true.
I don't understand your argument about why the court is not applying the new statute then.
Well, Your Honor, because they don't say that. They don't apply it. If they were to apply the statute itself, the entire statute, and not just the discovery rule, it would not be necessary to address the discovery issues. All they would have to say is suit is timely filed.
Unless you apply the statute, you don't have the discovery rule.
Well, I understand the dilemma, Your Honor. I understand the dilemma. This court has upheld its own rulings that the discovery rule applies to particular causes of action that are pending. In fact, the Burns versus Thomas case is one case where the petitioners requested that the court not apply the discovery rule because of the fact that the decision making it applicable came out after the case had been tried. And this court held that the law is that the court may apply or permit application of the discovery rule retroactively.
But the point we said in Alti there is no discovery rule for trade secret cases. So unless you have the statute, you don't have a discovery rule.
That's true. That's true.
I mean, cutting through it all, if the statute applies, you prevail on this, and if it doesn't, you don't.
Correct.
So the argument by petitioners is this application of the statute is unconstitutional.
Okay.
So would you give us just a capsule of the argument that it is constitutional?
Yes.
Now, you don't have to get into discovery rule or 3 years.
Okay. Capsule the argument, Your Honor. If you look at the case law that's cited by each and every one of these cases that are cited, you talk about when the cause of action accrues, which determines when the right to rely upon limitations vests. Our position is that if the law is unsettled at the time the case is filed, then the defendant does not have a vested right to rely upon the defense of limitations.
But if the law was settled, then you would concede petitioners were correct.
If the law was settled, Your Honor.
If the law was settled, then the legislature attempted more than they could legally do.
If you try to apply the entire statute, Your Honor, the three limitations period, that would be correct.
So what you're saying is that if we haven't answered the question of the discovery rule with respect to a particular tort, that you can't rely upon the statute of limitations?
If you have an accrual statute, Your Honor, that'd be true. Because the legislature has specifically left open the decision of when the cause of action accrues by virtue of including the accrual language and not specifying a particular date on which the limitations period begins to run.
Let me ask you a question. Did I understand that the motion for summary judgment based on limitations was, although interlocutory, a final judgment that disposed of the tort claim?
That would be true.
Well, does that mean that you could construe that Part B of 1610 applies rather than Part A2? Because there was a trial that determined limitations vis-a-vis that particular cause of action, so it's all over, and therefore the previous law applied.
I don't have Section B in front of me, Your Honor.
It says that an action commenced before the effective date of this act, which is the situation here. A trial, new trial, or retrial that's in progress on the effective date is governed by the law applicable to the trial immediately before the effective date.
And the question is whether or not that would...
That applies. If you're going to argue that 1610 applies, then the B part applies to say that the tort action was already barred because the trial was held on it
The summary judgment was granted on it, Your Honor, but
yes.
Our position is that we've still got a claim pending. The whole case is still alive.
Well, I understand, but you don't have legally now a claim pending for a tort action because the trial court's held it's barred by limitations, the two-year statute, which is what is in effect when that summary judgment was heard and determined.
That's what I said.
So why doesn't that end the limitations argument?
Well, Your Honor, like I've said, our position is that it's within the authority of the legislature to apply the discovery rule retroactively. So that our position is if the case is still pending, the court can go back and consider whether or not the discovery rule applies and resolve those factual issues.
But then you pointed out to us that I think Justice Hankinson said that the Court of Appeals applied the discovery rule based on the three-year statute.
That is correct.
But is there any question in your mind that it was discovered, even if it applies in April of 91?
Yes, Your Honor. The affidavit of Charlie Kimble states the actions that he undertook to try to determine whether or not Baker Hughes had actually used his trade secrets. He apparently had to go through a lot of investigation to determine whether or not they were producing
a
product.
So, I guess you wouldn't agree with the question I asked whether Part B applied instead of Part A2, because there was a trial on the tort claim before this act even became in effect.
That's right, Your Honor.
It seems to me, Ms. Bryant, your argument is this. If you had a trade secret case and you took it through the courts, got a judgment out of the court that your claim was barred because the court does not recognize a discovery rule, and the legislature shortly thereafter passes a statute saying the Supreme Court is wrong, that the discovery rule does apply to theft cases, that you would be entitled to that statute in re-bringing your claim to say it's not barred. In effect, you're saying the legislature has overruled our decision on whether or not the statute of limitations applies. And consequently, you should be entitled to re-urge your claim.
That is correct, Your Honor. Would the court like to hear the argument regarding Cincinnati Life, whether or not that case ought to apply to this situation?
Well, let me ask you, they brought a summary judgment. They claim there's no fact disputes about the breach of contract that's here, and they think as a matter of law they've established no breach of contract. What do you say are the fact issues?
The fact issues, Your Honor, number one, are whether or not the actual participation of Baker Hughes in manufacturing or having a competitor of Kiko manufacture a product in violation of the agreement, whether that constitutes breach of contract. Number two, if there are issues regarding the existence of trade secrets, which we think the summary judgment evidence at least establishes fact questions regarding whether the information claimed to be trade secrets was actually trade secrets and whether it had to have been used to manufacture this competing product. Whether or not it was used is an issue regarding breach of contract. I don't think you can affirm.
But coming back to the beginning, the product itself could not be used, in essence, to clone or redesign another product. That's the summary judgment record.
Without the use of trade secrets.
And what information was provided to Baker Hughes that, together with anything else, made it possible for them to redesign the product?
Well, I think one of the things, Your Honor, is the if you look at the affidavit of Charlie Kimble, there are certain things that have to take place before this product can be manufactured, especially the permeation barrier, the barrier that lets the gas escape at a certain rate. It has a special preparation, and that's the sort of information that Baker Hughes was seeking. That's the sort of information that Mr. Kimble was concerned about disclosing without the existence of a confidential disclosure agreement.
The record says he disclosed that before.
He indicates that he disclosed a number of trade secrets to
what?
Them.
And what I'm trying to get at is what?
Well, there was a dispute about how that should be disclosed, because once you disclose them, it's a matter of public record. So I think there was some difficulty in getting to the point of what are the trade secrets. There's also the issue of Mr. Kimball wasn't provided the opportunity to review or to examine the Chemtec product at the time to determine what was used.
Well, to come right down to it, the affidavit says Kiko made a number of disclosures of confidential and trade secret information to defendants prior to 6 December 1989. Is there any more in the summary judgment record about that subject than that statement?
Could I ask what page of the record you're reading from?
Yes, sir. That's page 385 of the record. That's Mr. Kimball's affidavit of February 1996. That's all I know about. But
yes, Your Honor. I had a duplicate site. I thought it might have been something different.
That's it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. I think I ought to, Your Honor. I've read the case 10 times, and what I get from the case is that it basically tells litigants and courts of appeals when they can review the denial of summary judgment. The case specifically states that under those circumstances, the summary judgment under review has to be case dispositive. I think some other courts have cited Cincinnati Life for the proposition that it applies when both parties file competing motions for summary judgment. I would submit that's the situation that Cincinnati Life is designed to cover. It's not designed to cover a situation where the trial court decides on her own initiative she doesn't have time to deal with the nuances of the case and dismisses the case without fully adjudicating all issues.
Why should it matter if you file three motions that in combination are dispositive, as opposed to combining them all in one motion?
Well, because the language of Cincinnati Life, Your Honor, it basically says that the motions will be case dispositive. But the question is going to be whether or not it is right for appeal.
At the end of the day, let's say I decide to file the same three motions, or they decide to file the same three motions in single documents, as opposed to spreading them out over a period of months. At the end of the day, the court ultimately rules on each piece of the summary judgment and have a final judgment. What difference does it make from a policy standpoint, appellate policy, whether you look at the summary judgment in a single document or you look at three separate summary judgments taken in combination that are dispositive?
I'm not sure that it actually does in practice. I didn't read the language of Cincinnati Life to be authorizing that. To me, that would be an interlocutory appeal of the denial of summary judgment. If you group them together, then I think Your Honor is correct. And that was the case that Cincinnati Life dealt with, was competing motions for summary judgment that are, in fact, case dispositive.
Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Bryant, going back to follow up a little bit on what Judge Hecht was talking with you about, your position is that Mr. Kimball says in his affidavit that trade secrets were used by Baker Hughes, but there's no place in specifically where he delineates what kind of information he's talking about and presented it to the trial court for consideration.
At some point it was presented, I believe, in the petitioner's motion for summary judgment, claiming that certain things are not trade secrets. Some of that information, Mr. Kimball's affidavit doesn't disclose which particular items were provided.
Well, is it correct that this information is now no longer trade secrets because this device has been patented and so it's in the public domain?
I'm not sure how to
so
answer that.
My point in all this is that was there any problem with joining issue on the summary judgment motion because of concerns about confidentiality over the information? And would there have been at that point in time since the device was patented?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Well, then how was that presented to the trial court so that your client would have the opportunity to present the evidence that it needed to controvert the breach of contract summary judgment motion?
The confidentiality issue, Your Honor?
Yes.
I think in response to the motion for summary judgment, I think one of the legal issues was whether or not it's necessary to have all trade secrets disclosed by virtue of the patent. There may be technical know-how. As I said, preparation of the permeation device, it's technical know-how. In fact, there's a letter attached to one of the motions, or one of the responses, from Trecor Atmos, Mr. Hayman, I think it is, where he says, we don't know what you're material is in the middle. We don't know what it is. That's one of the issues, Your Honor. That's sort of
my point in asking the question really is in terms of the state of the record. I kind of heard in response to Judge Heck's question that that's all he could say in the affidavit because they were trade secrets and there was a concern about revealing them. Is that right?
That is correct.
Well, was there any effort made, though, to provide that kind of information to the trial judge in a way to maintain the confidentiality so that the trial judge could have the information necessary to dispose of the motion? Was that issue even raised?
I can't tell you for sure, Your Honor. I know that there is a portion of the record that was sealed. I wasn't involved in trial in this case, so I don't know for a fact. I've reviewed the record, but I can't recall off the top of my head.
I have one quick question. I understand there's an affidavit testimony that this piece of equipment could not be reverse engineered because if you attempted to open it, certain parts would be destroyed. Is there any significance to the fact that, or any summary judgment proof that there's any significance to the fact that the piece of equipment was provided to Kentech disassembled?
It's evidence, Your Honor, that Baker Hughes wasn't simply looking for a replacement product. They actually participated in producing it, which in our opinion is a breach of contract. They are not allowed to do that. And again, if you look at the...
Well, I guess my question is, if it were produced disassembled so that these parts would not be destroyed from it, could it then be reverse engineered, or is there any summary judgment proof to that effect?
There is something to that effect, but I'm not sure that the device that was provided to Kentech is one of those devices. Mr. Kimball apparently had some concern at some point that people would be cutting this thing open, and so at some point he did start replacing component parts when they came back in for service or whatever with the type that would explode or something would happen internally. That would prevent it from being used again if they cut it open. Okay. I don't believe this is one of those, but I'm not for certain.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Yeah, please, the court. Justice Hankinson, if I may address the question you addressed to my opponent. There was no problem with Mr. Kimball being able to freely disclose trade secrets to us or to the court. There is a Rule 11 agreement among counsels functioning as a protective order in the record at 53. Moreover, as the court may be aware from our last point of error we raised, there's a significant part of the record that's missing. Specifically, the trial court went to great pains and efforts to get Mr. Kimball to disclose what he thought were trade secrets. It was a protracted discovery dispute, went on for quite a while. Ultimately, the court ordered him to list trade secrets. He ultimately did, pursuant to this protective order. There was an ex parte sealing order entered with regard to those lists of trade secrets after the final judgment was entered, and it's that trade secret list that is missing from the record that we discussed. So there's no, there was no impediment to his being able to come forward with additional summary judgment evidence to meet our summary judgment. That's just was not the case.
Why isn't his provision of those 18 or however many there were trade secrets in combination with the statement that he provided that before December 89, some evidence or raises fact issue that Baker Hughes could have pirated or reverse engineered or stolen the product?
Justice Hecht, I think that the critical distinction in the case, and I'm glad you asked me that question because I was going to address your questions next, there's a big distinction between what Baker Hughes knew and what Kentech knew. The whole case here is, did Baker Hughes somehow give information to Kentech when it manufactured the replacement conditioning unit that was a violation of this agreement? We do not dispute that there were other pieces of information that Baker Hughes had. The question is, what did Baker Hughes give, or stated differently, what did Kentech get? The summary judgment evidence is absolutely solid. Kentech received and used two things. Baker Hughes' test data, which was Baker Hughes' property, no dispute, and Baker Hughes' performance requirements, which are inherently, axiomatically, its own. It's not Kiko's trade secret or confidential information. It's Baker Hughes' requirements for its own conditioning unit and analyzer system. The only other thing that was provided is the Ranger, which, as the court has astutely observed, they have said cannot be reverse engineered and can't disclose anything. And to make it even stronger for summary judgment purposes, Kintec's people aver, and it's uncontroverted, that they didn't use it.
But you say in your brief it can be reverse engineered.
We believe that it could, yes.
So why doesn't that raise a fact question?
Because Kintec didn't use it. It's undisputed Kintec didn't use it. So whether it has trade secrets in it, whether it can be reverse engineered or not, doesn't matter in this case, because Kintec didn't use it to replicate the device.
Now,
they made their own device.
But now Mr. Kimball takes the position that Kintec could not have produced that product unless it had the information you say Baker didn't give them.
Right.
And unless they had the Ranger product, which you say the Kintec
didn't
use.
Correct.
Why isn't that a fact question?
Because the affidavit testimony that Mr. Kimball raises is no more than his own conclusion that he says, I don't believe, if you'll look at the affidavit that Justice Heck was reading from, he says, I don't believe that it would be possible for Kintec to have done this without using other information. But he doesn't say what other information. He doesn't say anything. I just don't think they could have done it. That kind of a conclusion we submit is completely...
But you have to shift the burden in the first instance. And you're asking us to take an interested witness's word for the fact that it wasn't used.
Well, I'm not so sure... certainly